Hey Slurper, whether you're talking about that crazy thing that happened at Craft Festival, the weird thing your dog did at the park, or the amazing dinner you whipped up from a virtually empty fridge, everyday stories hold the power to inspire and connect with your audience in a way that nothing else quite can. This won't be the first time you've heard this, I'm sure. We've been hearing marketers banging on about storytelling for a long time. But I've noticed that so many business owners are getting confused because no one really ever explains how to tell the stories that will help you sell more. I knew there had to be an easier way, so I've put together my own story formula to make it easy for you to be able to use stories in your social media, emails, and ultimately sell more. So I've put together a 90-minute workshop to teach you how, in a really simple way, you'll learn about the three types of stories you need to sell more, how to use those stories in your social media, blogs and emails, and I even guide you through how to start your very own story bank. Now you can get access anytime to this workshop right now if you like. Just visit the link thevictoriabrown.com/pickandmix to start learning how you can use the power of storytelling in your business and never wonder what you should be talking about on social media again.
I didn't really leave my flat for 18 months after that. It was pretty, you know, it was like you struck down once and then struck down again, and it was just like, wow, it took a long time to bounce back up from that.
That's the amazing Lisa Stickley. She's an illustrator who delightfully describes herself as a professional colourer inner. She's had so much business success, being stocked in household names like Harrods, Liberty, Paul Smith and Burberry, amongst others. And she's so generous in sharing her experience of when it all went wrong, her dyslexia diagnosis as an adult and losing her mom during lockdown. We talk about imposter syndrome, the importance of tenacity in business, being true to yourself and her love for Lidos. I just loved her honesty and humour despite everything that's happened and think you're going to love listening to this. Enjoy. Welcome to Creative Slurp Podcast, giving you the juice to build a successful creative business with me, Victoria Brown, a creative business advisor, former jeweller and craft fanatic. Now you're in the right place if you want to find real talk, inspiration and the best tips and strategies for your handmade business without the overwhelm. We're all about making business exciting and fun. Now buckle up and let's get started. Thank you so much for joining me today, Lisa. Your story is so inspirational. I think so many people will really benefit from hearing how you've got to doing what you're doing now and what you do really to get yourself through those tough times. I'm sure loads of people are experiencing at the moment. So for people that don't know much about you, can you please tell us about your business and how it all started?
Yes, well, it's funny thinking of it as a business because I've always worked for myself, but I guess it is, and I'm here. And I'm a textile designer by training, and I graduated from Central St Martin's back in 1999. And then I had a year out, went to the Royal College of Art and sort of officially started my textile brand, although I didn't really know it was a brand back then, or even if it is now. But, you know, I started making textiles to sell to people officially in sort of 2002, 2003. But prior to that, I'd already started selling stuff to Paul Smith and Designers Guild and The Cross. Do you remember The Cross that used to be right next to Kath Kidston's first shop, which I went into when Kath was serving at the till? Huge inspiration. And yeah, that was after graduating from printed textiles at Central St Martin's. I sort of thought, oh, this is good, I love this. I've always loved being creative, but at that time I was lucky and I'd sold quite a lot of stuff at Final Show. And so I moved back home with my parents in Hertfordshire, and my dad let me have the garage to use as a studio. So I did a proper Heath Robinson, set up a very basic print table and got all the inks and things from the guys we used to use at college, Quality Colours. You could get sample pots. And I built an exposure unit, which was hilarious. And I started making some things. And I just, like a bull at a gate, kind of phoned round some buyers and stuff. Didn't really know what a buyer's role was, but, you know, just thought, oh, I think that's what we've got to do, we'll do that. And I had a 20-minute meeting with a buyer from Paul Smith Floral Street store in Covent Garden. And God, I learned more in that 20 minutes than, you know, for the non-creative side of business than I learned in the whole 3 years at college. And it was very eye-opening and quite hardcore. But she ended up buying a load of little bags from me that I went back home and sewed up. And there they were in Paul Smith, with the old labels that I had left over that Mum used to sew into our socks at school.
Brilliant. Sustainability even then. So how did it feel getting so much success? Now, Paul Smith, that's a huge name. How did it feel getting that success so early in your career?
Well, I thinking back when I was doing all of that, it was amazing. You know, it was incredible to be seeing your things in store. But I think you just... you know, you're always sort of thinking, what's next and how can I improve on that? And what am I going to do next? Because if I am going to make this into a business, then, you know, it's got to work. So I think, and I'm not very good at patting myself on the back and going, oh, well done. I'm very much right. That's done. Great. Brilliant. What's next? You know, and so, yes, looking back to it now, you know, I feel hugely privileged that they even had a meeting with me. And I sometimes wish I had that sort of just go for it gusto that I had when I was in my early 20s. But I feel very proud, you know, to have just got on with it, really, and been lucky that people liked my work. It's those pinch me moments, but you just want it to be moving forward all the time and improving. And so, yeah, I'm probably quite hard on myself really thinking about it. But I feel very lucky.
Yeah, I think you definitely are. But I think a lot of us are. I mean, for you, example, you've worked with people like Liberty, Selfridges, Debenhams, Harrods. I mean, they're a huge, huge name. So you should definitely be proud of yourself.
I remember getting into Harrods, actually. That was after I'd finished my MA at the Royal College. And I was very lucky and was picked up by the World of Interiors at the end of year show. And they always did a feature on the Royal College of Art. But for that year, for some reason, they did a double page on me sitting in Hyde Park, because I based my whole collection around the English tea room. And I remember Tom Mannion was a brilliant photographer, and he set me up with a sort of picnic thing and cups and saucers, and I had to sit there pretending I was pouring a cup of tea. But that just launched everything. And I'd always wanted to work for myself and never sort of was really interested in working for anybody else. So I then was very lucky and got a commission from Burberry, who contacted me through that. And then, you know, things started to happen from there. And so, but the Harrods thing was quite interesting, because I was printing on vintage tablecloths, and I used to go to Kempton Park a lot. And I'd picked up, it's like a race, Kempton Park Racecourse. They have an antiques fair there I think it's second and last Tuesday of the month or something like that. Anyway, it's still there. It's brilliant fair. I picked up a load of old Harrods tablecloths from the 1920s or something. And I printed back on them. But to get into Harrods, I was working at Carluccio's part-time at the time, which is always a good thing when you work for yourself, I think, because it is up and down. To have a part-time job that you can just go to. I did two double shifts a week, 2 days, and I used to leave at 7 in the morning at my mum and dad's and get back about 2 in the morning. But that gave me 5 days the rest of the week to do my own stuff, you see. But I remember on my lunch breaks, I think it was about 2 months, I'd phone Helen, the buyer's assistant in Harrod, and say, hi, Helen, it's me again. Can I have an appointment now, please? Until she basically told me to bugger off or said yes. And they said yes. And then I met the lovely Geraldine James, who, you know, we still sort of chat on Instagram and stuff like that now and again now. And yeah, wonderful lady.
So you'd say a lot of it's probably down to connections then, I guess, and getting your name out there.
Being really annoying and persistent and just not, you know, just being really annoying, like a kind of, yeah, just really annoying, basically, until they either tell you to go away or say, you know. But hopefully, I don't think they would have put me in their shop if they just thought I was annoying. I think they liked my stuff too.
No, they might have called security if they thought you were just annoying. Yeah. They didn't like your stuff. Lucky they didn't like your stuff, really. So where did your passion for art come from, though, if you've always been creative as a child?
My mum used to say I was drawing as soon as I could pick up a pencil. Mum wasn't creative at all. She was an infertility technician. Dad paints a bit, but he's very, very shy about it. And he's very good when he does it. But to get him to do it is like pulling teeth. But my auntie was very creative. She had a work room. She was always knitting, sewing, making, baking, whatever. and I spent a lot of time with her, and I thought she was sort of pushing me along, but apparently it was me going, come on, let's make something all the time. So she, you know, got me going a lot, and it was I feel very, very lucky to, it's always been my passion. That's just always been that, which in whichever way I might do it is going to be something creative. I found out when I was in my first year at St. Martin's that I'm dyslexic too, and that explained a lot of things. Why I failed geography and stuff like that, and why I couldn't sight read still after learning the piano for many years. But I think when something like that is undiagnosed, you kind of have to push harder with the things that you're good at. And I'm not good at reading and taking in information and regurging it. So things like history, geography, I was great at the practical stuff, going on the hikes and jumping in the rivers and things like that. But, and DT, for example, the theory stuff, I really struggled with. But the making, you know, I made a double futon bed that turned into a sofa and a reclining thing out of solid pine, and enjoyed myself thoroughly. And so I think maybe that, thinking back now, that might have steered me a lot, because I, you know, you just naturally are pushed to the, you've got to survive in life, right? So you've got to kind of do what you can do, but also a love for it. You know, I, even if I wasn't doing it for a career, and there have been times when it's been very, very dark and very, very tough, but it's always been creativity that I've gone back to as my, it's my hobby, you know, it's my go-to. It's just there. And I know a lot of people don't know what they want to do in life, and I think, you know, that must be very difficult, to just be good at lots of things but not have a real fire burning to do any one thing, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
I'm just very lucky that I have this passion.
I know a lot of people actually that describe their dyslexia as a superpower.
Yeah,
especially when diagnosed later on.
Yeah, it's a strange thing. I mean, I remember having the diagnosis and I wrote to my school so they would look out for other people. I was really disappointed with it, because I cried when, you know, I just didn't really even know what dyslexia was. I remember telling my mum, I was so upset, she thought I was pregnant. And you know, I didn't really know or understand kind of what it was. And because you're dyslexic and struggle with reading complicated things, you don't understand the diagnosis review and stuff much either, so it's not very helpful. But the school were like, well, you've got, you know, you're getting on with what you want to do, so that's fine. And I was like, well, no, I want you to put something in place to look out for this in the future. Luckily, schools seem to be moving on a bit. I think the curriculum is still very difficult, in that you know, it's still very exam based in a lot of subjects and stuff. But we've got two young daughters, and our eldest has just been diagnosed as well. Fun enough, I don't know if it's hereditary or what, but, you know, I'm seeing from her point of view, and because I work in schools and with a reading charity, I'm seeing the side of being a young child and sort of dealing with how to learn to read. Oh my God, isn't it hard to learn to read English? My goodness.
And no, my five-year-old's just starting to learn, and I'm like, how did, like, I can't even remember not reading.
Yeah, I still, you know, I seem to be not too bad at spelling, but it's taking in information, like instructions and stuff like that, I'm really bad at. And even, you know, terminology in English and how to form a sentence and stuff like that, I can't get my head around it at all. But somehow I seem to be okay at putting it out there, because, you know, I've managed somehow to publish 9 books along the way. And it's really strange, because the instructions that I write in my sewing and making books, I write them all, but when I read them back, I'm like, no, I really wouldn't be able to understand this. I don't think I wouldn't. I'd really struggle to follow those instructions to me, but I can explain to someone how to do it. It's very odd.
That's really interesting that you find it difficult to follow instructions, because I would say, and I might be wrong, as a creative, somewhere along the line, you've probably learned some of the skills that you're using. You use a lot of different skills. Are they all self-taught then? Or did you have instructions somewhere along the line? Or how did that work?
Well, I think you have instructions, but you would take in information in a different way. For example, learning the piano, I realized I was playing by ear. I'd watch my teacher play something and I'd be able to listen to it and take in that. And it's really weird. I can remember song lyrics. It's so weird. But I can't, you know, if somebody told me, you know, when somebody stops you in the car and you're driving along, oh, excuse me, can you tell me the directions to so-and-so? I can maybe remember the turn right ahead bit, but anything after that, it just doesn't stay in my brain. So it's very strange how a dyslexic mind works compared to a, I don't know what you call it, a normal brain. I don't know. I think everybody has got very different ways to work.
I'm starting to think there isn't a normal, because you've seen the increasing number of people now being diagnosed with ADHD as well. And you're starting to realize actually there is no one normal way of addressing things and thinking things and approaching things.
No, but it's so formulaic still at school.
Yes, we are expected to be, and you almost get into trouble if you're not following the instructions that you're given when you can't, if you can't physically do it, that's really unfair.
Yeah, and you see these bright kids, you know, and we listen to a lot of audibles and things like that, and seeing my daughter and other children I work with taking in so much information from what they hear, but going into blind panic and real scared faces when they have to sort of try and read something, and you know, anything in their power to not sit down and do any reading. And you know, I was the same. I wasn't a big reader, and now I kind of know why. But Audible is brilliant. I've been listening to that and podcasts and stuff like that. You know, I don't really listen to music when I work, but I can't say I've read loads of books. I've listened and absorbed so many more books since, you know, you could listen to them rather than read them. And it's not that I can't read, you know, I used to get into stuff. Wilbur Smith I used to be able to read quite well, and you know, maybe a little bit of Jackie Collins here and there and stuff like that when I was a lot younger. But it took a lot for me to be able to concentrate enough on a book to really get into it, you know.
So because of your dyslexia, do you think that's why you're working with the charity Beanstalk now that supports children to learn to read?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I wanted to do something, and, you know, as I said, I've been lucky enough to have a number of children's books published, and I just wanted to sort of be able to do something linked in with that. And yeah, it's so brilliant. They send volunteers into schools to sit with the children who are struggling and help them learn to read, basically. And I just think it's important and, you know, nice. And I mean, I don't donate money or anything like that. I haven't, you know, got enough of a, I'm not in a position to be able to do that, but, and I don't do a lot, but I will do author visits for them. And I've in the past sold tea towels that, you know, and all the profits go to them, and various visits and things, and anything I can, you know, to try and help. But yeah, I think it's important, and it makes me, I don't know if it should get to a certain point in life where you want to be able to give back a bit more. And, you know, if you can't give lots of money because you haven't got lots of money to be able to do something like that, then at least you can do something. And I don't know, it's just something I really wanted to do. So I just called them up one day and said, could I be involved, please? And we're doing lots of things. Funnily enough, I was cycling to the Lido this morning to have my swim, and I just left my road, and I was following this chap on his bike, and then I nearly got to the Lido, and I was like, oh my God, he's going to think I'm following him. It's like a 20-minute cycle. So he stopped at the lights, and I said, oh, I'm really not following you, I promise. And he was like, oh, yeah. And I said, are you off to work? And he said, well, I'm retired, but I'm actually going to help a school in Brixton. And I said, oh, that's interesting. I work for a charity, you know, called Beanstalk. And he said, oh, that's who it is. But it was so nice to see this man who was off to school to help these, you know, children. So I'm glad working.
Oh, brilliant. And it just seems that you've had so many opportunities in your career that have come along. I think part of that's down to luck. I think part of that's down to that you just ask. Like, I think that people forget that they can just ask for things in business. You know, how are people going to know what you want to do unless you ask them or tell them?
Well, exactly. And I mean, we were talking before we started this about the old imposter syndrome and all that stuff, because I've had to morph into different things along the journey of my career. I mean, the imposter syndrome is mega, and I still get it all the time. And so I think the older I get, the more nervous I get. But when you do ask, it's, you know, that's exactly right. People don't know that you want to do something. I mean, we'll probably go on to this in a bit more detail later, but I've started doing these doodling books and things in the last year, which have been sort of taking off. But I work with Dulwich Picture Gallery in the past, and they started selling them in their shop, and I just sort of said on the end of an email, oh, if you fancy me doing one for you, you know, specific to the gallery. And they said, yes, please. So I worked on that for the last 6 months, and we pressed print on it on Friday last week.
Just shows, doesn't it? If you don't ask, you don't get. So just ring up Harrods and annoy them until they agree to stop and we'll work with you.
Tenacious, yeah. Poor Helen, she was very patient.
You also talked, you know, amongst the good times, you said there were some dark times as well. Could you talk a little bit more about those?
Yes, it's I was thinking about this on my bike ride this morning, how to describe it. And I mean, I started, as I said earlier, I've never worked for anybody else. I've done projects for other people, you know, things like that, and I have had part-time jobs along the way, you know, even more recently too, which are very helpful when you're trying to do your own thing and times are a bit tough. So I built up my business basically when I left the Royal College. I had a lovely lady who worked as my agent for a few years, and it was just with her help we sort of managed to get into the likes of Liberty's and Heels and lots of stores in the UK. And I very early on had contact from Japan and started selling to Japan, to Ships stores, which I sold to them for 10 years, I think. And I sold to Liberty's for 10 years. And, you know, the business grew and things evolved. And when I was very lucky with press. They were quite interested in what I was doing. And also I was tenacious with that. You know, I remember sitting in the garden thinking, right, how am I going to do a press release? I had no idea what a press release was, but you know, I've got to write to these people and tell them what I'm doing. So I got all the broadsheets and looked for the features editor and just wrote them all down and sent out these ridiculous press releases that were just hilarious. But you know, I think the more you knock on people's doors, if somebody listens and something happens with that, it always leads on to something else. And as the years went on, we started doing trade shows and things like that. I went to Frankfurt, which was great fun, and Paris, and we used to do Top Draw and then Spring Fair in Birmingham for many years. And you know, it grew and I got an assistant and then more press, and then business folk started sniffing about. And I was young and just really wanting my business to work. I didn't really understand the business side of things, or didn't have confidence that I did. I don't know, you know, it's that classic cocktail of creative person meets business person. And I think a lot of the time, those two minds are very different and have very different outlooks, morals, just views. And, you know, I started because I started selling stuff to my friends, and then their friends wanted some, and then their friends wanted some. I didn't ever sit down and think, well, I'm going to create a brand that's going to do X, Y, Z and have projections of this in 5 years' time and exit strategies and blah, 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 blah. I started making stuff and selling it. And, you know, I was very lucky that people liked it and it grew, and it did grow very organically. But I then, you know, I did get involved with a number of different people. And after I opened a shop, which was in Clapham in 2007, which was fantastic. It was we had the whole downstairs as a print studio and offices out the back. And then it was a shop frontage. I mean, it wasn't on the high street. It was not on the high street. No, it wasn't. And I know those lovely ladies, they came in when they were starting on high street too, but they've done a fantastic job. But yeah, I opened a shop. So it was shop frontage, but that was another step for the press. You know, you've suddenly got a shop showroom, and it was 200 meters from the tube. So it wasn't really cheap because it wasn't a high street, but the Japanese could come, and they did, and lots of other people, and you had a place to show off your stuff. Yeah. So long story short, I then needed, I'd never had any money apart from a bit of help from mum now and again, but not anything, you know, substantial put into the business. It just did grow organically, and I did live on baked beans for a very long time. I did need some money to take it forward because we were getting lots of orders, and you just need cash flow to be able to, you know, fulfill stuff. So I I did get some backers involved. And like I say, I was young. I didn't really know. Well, you know, I wasn't that young then. But I'm not from a business background. And I think we had very different ideas. And I certainly didn't have the confidence to stand up for myself or know even how to, or even know the right shareholders. I mean, I saw a lot, you know, I saw what I thought would be the right people to be able to be safe in this new setup, but it turned out that it wasn't. And I ended up, I guess the cocktail didn't taste particularly sweet in the end. And I was probably loyal to the wrong people. And I do kick myself sometimes for being loyal when other opportunities presented themselves. But I said, no, 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 I can't possibly do that because I'm, you know, anyway, I ended up resigning from my business after sort of, what, 10 years of hard slog. I lost control and I couldn't stand with my name above the door. It just wasn't happening the right way, if you know what I mean. So I walked away and lost my name for 4 years because there was a one-liner in the shareholders agreement that said nobody within this business shall use the name outside of the business. But I sort of never foresaw that I would end up being so miserable that I would leave. But and it's hard, you know, looking back now, that was a, you know, a long time ago, and you know, nobody won. It wasn't nice, and you know, I didn't know what else to do. And I had a wonderful team of girls who were just brilliant, and oh, things got quite dark and messy. And I think even now about how, you know, I might have been really horrible to them one day, whatever, because it was so stressful. And and they were so loyal to me, and it was, I, you know, you look back on these things, don't you? And it, but as with everything, it is a journey, and painful as it was at the time, you know, I wouldn't be where I am now had that not happened, if you know what I mean. And I did have a go at something new after that, because some people who had wanted to invest set me up with a new, we started a new label, which was quite short-lived really in the end, called Betty and Walter. And I did a big collaboration with Boots for 2 years running with that. And we got it to sort of certain level. But then again, it's, you know, who you trust within your business. And sadly, there was somebody who was doing stuff that we didn't know about in the business, and it sadly had to be closed. And I just was like, oh my God, I don't know what to do now. This is definitely not a direction that I can go in, because I am not the person who can figure out what everyone else is doing and be able to trust people. So my eldest daughter was 10 months old then. So and I'd had a pretty yucky, you know, I'd suffered from postnatal depression. It'd been a bit dark after having her. And I went from one day having a really solid business where we were going to be, you know, really starting to get it going, to the next day it all falling to pieces. And I didn't really leave my flat for 18 months after that. It was pretty, you know, it was like be struck down once and then struck down again. And it was just like, wow, this is, I really, it took a long time to bounce back up from that. My mum used to always describe me as one of those weebles that get knocked down, falling back up again. It took a while for that, to get over that. And I don't know really if I've still sort of, I don't know. Again, it was, you know, it's so sad. People work so hard when you have your own business, and it, when stuff happens like that, you know, you've got people who've put their hard-earned money into things, and it just all falls to pieces. I guess it happens a lot, but it just feels so wasted. And that's sad. So I knew then that I wouldn't ever go down that road again of getting backers and stuff. And I'm just not the right person to do that. And I had a lovely invite from Molly Mex to go and be a judge on one of their sort of entrepreneurial days. And I went and did that. And sort of during that time of hiding in my flat, my mum and a few friends and family had sort of said, you know, have you ever thought of about children's books? Because obviously I've always drawn and, you know, have a sort of really bonkers outlook on life. And I love children and telling stories and colouring in, you know, it's, you know, I hadn't ever thought of that. But I did sort of start to really think about it and scribble down a few ideas and things. And at this Molly Makes Day, there was a publisher there called Pavilion Books. I'd already had published my first sewing book before this, but Quadrille, who I'd worked with for that, didn't do children's books, so I needed somebody else to kind of to go to. Anyway, I met up with these guys at lunchtime, and I was very lucky to have a meeting with their CEO, and the week later, and even luckier when she gave me a 3-book deal, which was fab.
Amazing.
Another sort of, oh my gosh. And I somehow managed to have 7 books published between then. That was 2016. I had my first children's book published, and then my latest one, which feels quite a way away now, was 2019 with Tate Publishing. And I still pinch myself and feel like a complete imposter in this industry even still. And I now realize how hard it is, because I've submitted to my agent a number of books, and they, you know, you get lovely feedback, but it does make me realize how very lucky I have been to have the ones I've had published. And I've gotten to the point where I've written a number of books, and I sadly lost my mum 2 years ago to cancer. And so we had quite a year of looking after her where we could. It was lockdown and we didn't really get to see her very much, but and then she died in September 2020, and she loved so many of the books I'd been scribbling down. She was always the one I would show first, and I sort of I have all these ones, and I've shown my agent, and I kind of want to submit them, but something is stopping me. I sort of really lost my confidence a bit in that at the moment, but I shall do it. I've got a Just Do It sign on my wall, just to put a few illustrations together for each one to put them in for submission. But I think, yeah, it's been a tough time emotionally, and you know, for everybody with lockdown and everything. But yeah, that's a very fond memory, sitting in cafes with my mum and showing her my scribbles. Well, they're not scribbles, I usually write them in notes on my phone, and her laughing away, and then making sure I've spelt everything correctly and done the right grammar. So that kind of was a real switch up of direction for me. But what I have found is that the children's book industry is just lovely. There's such lovely people in it, and it is an absolute delight to be able to create a book and a story that you can go into schools and read to children, and your kids can, you know, read along with you. And it's something very magical and very special, and it is a complete labor of love, because, you know, unless you're sort of on one of the piles, you know, tables in Waterstones, children's authors don't earn a great deal of money, and you certainly don't get paid anything at all until you've come up with a story, and if you're illustrating it, 2 illustrations and stuff. So it's a real labor of love to get it to that stage and then submit it and hope that somebody might publish it.
You've got all these different creative outlets. So obviously at the moment you're doing lots of books, but you've done loads of doodling and all sorts of other things in the past, and products. Where do you get your inspiration from? And do you ever get creative block?
Oh, always, 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 always. I don't know where the inspiration comes from. My brain doesn't really ever switch off, but I used to get creative. Yeah, I've always had creative block. What I used to do to overcome that was, I've always kind of been obsessed with kids writing and, you know, old lined paper or anything old, ephemera, that sort of thing. So I used to sit and get these huge old tablecloths or pieces of fabric and stitch turquoise lines in pieces of fabric to sort of create my own fabric paper, I guess. But that process of doing something really monotonous that takes a long time, I realized really gets, it frees up your brain. It worked the same when I worked at Sainsbury's and I was stacking the pick and mix. That was quite good. I remember figuring out a skirt pattern plan for that while I was stacking the pick and mix. It's that, you know, it's the doing something physical, I think. It happens when you go on a walk. I write lots of stories. My brain's ticking when I'm sitting on the bus. I now swim a lot more than I used to, and I've been coming up with lots of ideas doing lengths in the Lido. But that is something that, I'm 45 now, and I think since losing my mum and since life has been challenging in lots of different ways, it's only in the last year or so, with the help of a friend who's sort of been helping me just review what I've been doing within my business and see what's working, and just having another mind to bounce things off. I've realized that drawing has always been my go-to, always. I had, you know, quite a challenging upbringing in lots of ways that I won't really go into, but it has always been there and I've never really realized it. And I started doing workshops. I've always done workshops here and there, dotted about, but I started doing them weekly just after lockdown because a mum asked me if I would do some evening ones so she could get out of bath time once a week. And I said, all right, then, yes, I will. And it's amazing that all started to knit together as well, that people, creative or not creative at all, would leave these workshops that sometimes I'd be doing for kids and the parents would sit down and have a go, you know, and they'd just say, oh, I feel so much better. And all of these things just sort of dawned on me about a year ago. And so I started thinking about it an awful lot more. And then I created these online workshops, which I didn't want to go online at all because I don't like Zoom and I'm still not very good at it, but it seems to work. And they're called creative doodling. And I've called it doodling because I didn't want to scare anybody off. It's not Royal College of Drawing or anything like that, or even A-level drawing. It's kind of partly to get your creative juices going again by that sort of mindful kind of taking time out to do something else. I guess it's enough of a focus to just be doing, but letting your mind relax and start ticking again. And it's also for mental health. I think it's really quite important, and it's, you know, since doing it, I get so many people still saying, oh, I feel so much better. And so it's for that sort of creativity and mental health that we do an hour and a half each week, and they're all recorded so people can't make it, they can catch up. And it's guided drawing, so you have 12 drawings per session. Some are 1 minute, some are 10 minutes and everything in between. And I send out a really nice box of kits so everybody has everything they need. And you don't even have to think, because I'm like, draw this dog with a blue collar on this paper with pastel or whatever it is. And so it just allows everybody to do, and they'll probably try different techniques that they have never tried before. And some work, some don't. So I do it with them. Some of mine are all right, some of mine are really rubbish. But it's that process that's the thing here. It's like, you know, as a professional colorer in her, I still, things don't work every time. And I remember seeing Tracy Emin, a documentary on her, and she said, you know, that's what she does. She spends 20 minutes in the morning just doing something on paper, because that gets out all the angst and all the nervousness, and they seem to be really working. I've got people from all over the world who come draw me. Brilliant. Fantastic. And then these doodling books have come off the back of that, which are just A5, all found paper reprinted, because I hate drawing in a brand new sketchbook. It scares me to death. And again, it's guided drawing. So, you know, you can pick out a page. I guess it's like a move on from colouring in, really. It just tells you what to do. You don't have to think too much, but you can do the doing.
I love that, because it just takes that procrastination away. Because how many times have you thought, oh, I'm going to do something, and then, oh, but I don't know what colours to do, I don't know which pen to use, I don't know what thing to do, and then you end up not doing it at all.
Well, exactly. It's like all these, you know, these new fab cooking boxes you can get. They give you all the ingredients and tell you what to cook, but you still get to do the cooking.
Yeah,
which isn't quite, you know, another stress reliever if you enjoy cooking. But it's sort of, it just takes away that pressure and gets you doing, and then, you know, who knows what will happen after that. It's the loosening up a bit. It's like stretching before a run or what have you.
Amazing. Yeah, I so agree. And when I'm writing, for example, I agree with like getting ideas when you're not doing, when you're doing something you're not supposed to be doing, not supposed to be having ideas, if that makes sense. Yes. So like when I'm in the shower, when I'm going for a walk or a run, those are when my ideas pop into my head. You can guarantee it. Or if I'm really stuck and I'm writing something, I've got to be at my desk, I just write. And even if just like you write about the mundane and just write blah 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 blah, and you can't do that for that long before ideas start coming in your head. It's
impossible. Oh really, is that what you write? Blah 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 blah.
If I was really stuck, I started doing this journal. I don't know if you've heard of The Artist's Way. where she talks about doing morning pages and writing. And sometimes I do it. And there's a website online called 750words.com. And sometimes I just write the 750 words every morning, because that equates to 3 pages. And I will just start off saying, blah, blah, blah. Oh, I'm really sick of saying blah, blah, blah. What can I see out the window? And I just go on and on. But it gets all those words and it sounds bonkers, but you cannot, I've tried, and you cannot say blah, blah, blah for too long before you get bored, and then other ideas start creeping, and you see a cat out the window, or you see something, and then something creeps in your head from last night or whatever. Yes. And you just put it all down, and then all these ideas start coming up afterwards, like get us all the, like you say, the rubbish.
Right? Yes, it's something about getting stuff out. Yeah. Oh, how interesting. Oh, I might try blah 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 blah. That's very Donna Wolf, that, isn't it? You could have her blah 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 blanket and wrap it around you while you're doing blah.
Yeah, it works. I think, like you say, it's action as well. I do think, I'm a big believer in action. Once you start taking action, it gets not addictive, it's not the word, but things start happening, even things that you didn't expect to happen start happening.
Yes, and it's the same with the, you know, with the getting out there and doing, you know you can go and talk to 10 million people, or you can be doing a fair, weekend fair or something, and you won't sell much at all, and you're like, oh, but something, you will learn something from everything you do. And I think it was Michael Caine who said, you know, he, as a jobbing actor, I remember in his autobiography, he's, you know, he said, you just got to take everything, every opportunity that comes along, don't be picky, because no matter if it's really, you know, it's a crap film or whatever, or it's pouring with rain, or it's miserable, blah, 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 there will be something from that experience that will get you on like a stepping stone to the next thing. And I think if you look with optimistic, enthusiastic eyes through life, and you take the opportunities that come your way, and you just try it, you know, what's the worst that can happen? It's, you know, it could go terribly wrong, which for me, it's gone terribly wrong a number of times. But all of that is lessened for the next step. You know, it is a journey. And let's face it, you know, life would be pretty dull if we all knew what we were doing, wouldn't it?
And it must seem when things go right, because you've seen the bad times, it must seem even better when it goes right.
It's very good, but and you do, again, I'm still not very good at looking, stepping back and having a look. It's trying that. The thing that really gets me is when I talk to people and they'll randomly pull out one of my old purses from their bag. I've had this for 10 years. I'm sorry to keep talking about the Lido. It seems I'm going there a lot lately. But a lady there the other week had one of my makeup bags. So I said, oh, that's nice. And she said, oh, yeah, I bought it years ago from this lovely shop in Clapham or whatever. And I was like, oh, no, I know. You know, it's one of mine. I made it. And she was like, oh, wow. Really funny. But that's really lovely, you know, when people are actually using it. And I think that's what's nice about being back on my own again, because I get to interact with customers directly, and it is just me here. I mean, my husband very kindly helped me out sometimes, and I've got my friend who's helping me with my sort of strategy a bit and marketing and stuff, but it is me packing all the boxes and going to the post office and writing all the lesson plans and somewhere writing books and doing paintings in between, and you know, but it's I sort of can't picture not doing that. I did take a role at Bowdoin for a while at maternity cover, because it was one of the, you know, tricky times, and my husband unfortunately had been made redundant, and we really needed some income, and there was this role going, and the girls were lovely, and Johnny's lovely, and such a strong sort of well-run business. I was hopeless. I didn't know what I was doing. I was so used to doing everything that just doing one thing, I think it's that interaction of, and this is another reason I work for myself, I think, because I struggled to take in information, I felt helpless. You know, I didn't understand what the instructions were so much. And you sort of constantly having to juggle the thoughts of 20 other people, and I couldn't manage it. I felt I was rubbish, honestly. I'm unemployable.
I'm sure you are, but I know what you mean. It's very different, I think, running everything and kind of seeing an overview of everything, doing everything your own way, compared to working in a company where you have a very small focus is on one thing. If you, when you have a larger company, I used to work as part of a company of 6,000 people, my focus was very small on one particular thing. And now I love the fact that I get to do everything myself. That's probably to my own detriment because I find it really hard to let go. Yeah. But I like doing everything. But that kind of that ability to do everything in your business, that probably is easier than it's ever been, I'm guessing, because the amount of tools that are out there now that just wouldn't have been out there 10 years ago to help you do it yourself.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I started, you know, as I say, back in 1999 when, you know, I phoned my mum from a phone box to tell her what results I got from my degree with 20p. I think it's even not even 20p now. It's more than that, if you can find one that works. Very much so. You know, I relied back then on press, printed press. I had a mailing list, which was great, but there wasn't Instagram, there wasn't, you know, TikTok or Facebook or anything like that. What was it? Friends Reunited.
Yes, the very first social media. You can forget that.
You know, letter writing and stuff like that. It wasn't quite that. But it's very different now. And I think the fact that the world has opened up to small businesses with the likes of Etsy and Not on the High Street and all these fantastic businesses that are championing tiny brands is amazing. And, you know, there is room for everyone, I believe. And it's interesting, again, saying, you know, I've got this imposter syndrome for children's books. And I went with my lovely friend Jane Foster to the Bologna Book Fair for the first time earlier this year. And I was petrified. I was thinking, oh my God, I'm going to feel even more imposter syndrome going here because it's all of the illustrators from, you know, across the globe. It was incredible. And the variety and just sheer volume of illustrators and styles and so on was massive. And it just sort of made you think, there really is, you know, it made me think, stick to your guns and stop, you know, when you sort of think, oh, I must try and be this, or I must try and be that, or I must try and be the other, so then people will like what I'm doing. I think when things are true to you and you really, and this is something I have to tell myself all the time, you know, try and be true to yourself. And then if you love what you're doing, other people will come along. So that, yeah, it was really great place to visit. And I was surprised at how I felt coming back, but quite a lot heavier too, because we did a lot of eating in Bologna.
Of course, that's amazing. But it is so true. And I think sometimes you've just got to push yourself to get, you know, to have those experiences that may be a little bit scared of.
Yeah, awkward experiences are quite good.
Yeah, but you do grow quite a lot.
You do. And again, you know, you learn all these things that you, if you don't, you know, what happens if you do nothing, then you're not going to learn anything, are you? So.
No, exactly. No, I think it's amazing. And talking about marketing, I really love the way you do your marketing. I'm going to mention it because it's so different from what I see a lot of people do. And I love the fact that your brand is infused into, I'm talking about your emails particularly, but everything really, your brand look and feel. And you can just tell it's you. And I'm going to point out specifically that when you've got words at the top, you use a mix of uppercase and lowercase, which nobody else, I've never, ever seen that, ever. But I love it. And I think it really, really appeals to your customers because it just shows your personality straight away. And I just think it's brilliant. It's genius.
Well, thank you. I always wonder whether that's really difficult to read, because I did my first sewing book was all, I insist, everything was always lowercase when I sort of first started. And we did the whole book all lowercase. And it actually was quite difficult to read. You know, there is a certain punctuation between sentences when it starts with a capital letter. But oh, I'm glad. I particularly like the doodling because I want to put two little googly eyes in between that. But I'm glad you noticed that. Thanks.
And I think I just wanted to mention it because I'm a big, massive fan of email marketing. And I think so many people are really scared of email marketing. They think that they're just selling at their customers, that they'll drive their customers away, that they can't show their personality. But I think in your emails, it shows you can do it with warmth and love and your personality, because And they don't have to be a chapter and verse either. They don't have to be really long. They can just, you know, your emails are just a few images with a few words sprinkled in, and it doesn't take a long time. And it does feel loving and warm and friendly. And it's a really good example of how to do email marketing that fits well with your brand.
Oh, great. Well, that's really, I'm very pleased with that, because I used to, 10 years ago, we used to send out emails and all sorts of other things too. But, and then Instagram was born, and, you know, a lot of my customers were coming from Instagram, but now it's gone all doolally and God knows what's going on with it. People seem to be not being able to be seen anymore. And we've spent, you know, years and years trying to, it's just a bit annoying. Anyway. So there does seem to be a big trend in moving back to, you know, having a mailing list and so on. And I've been trying really hard this year to get into a bit of a rhythm, because I wasn't really doing anything much. And I'd be like, oh, God, I've got to do another email. I can't remember, you know, I haven't done another one. And this is where my friend Josie has helped me just put a bit of a structure to it. But then I do exactly like you say, you know, there's, it's always so much easier, isn't it, to sell someone else's stuff than your own?
Yes.
I mean, I'm hopeless. I'm really rubbish. You know, I'm, you know, oh, have it. And then I'm like, well, no, I need to actually earn some money.
So true.
So it's, to shout about yourself, well, is never very nice. It's like having your picture taken. It's just a bit cringy. However, I sort of thought, well, I can do some fun stuff in here. Oh my goodness. Grown-ups love a spot the difference. They love it. And honestly, the responses I get are hilarious. And then I thought, well, what can I do over the summer? Because people are going to be doing their summer holidays and stuff, and I don't want to bombard them with boring emails. So I thought, oh, no, I'll do a competition, and it will keep me on my toes drawing every day. And so I'll do a doodle a day. And so people were sending me their holiday pictures and holiday diary doodles, I called it. So that was really fun. And then I've started doing Win Wednesdays, where we do Spot the Difference once a month, favorite portrait, which might be one of mine or one of another artist, you know, all this stuff. And then I try and do a bit more of a salesy one on Sundays. And I just have just finished a big marketing campaign for my doodling classes, which was offering, you know, free trial and things like that. And even that, I feel like I've been like, oh my goodness, I've been really overdoing it. But then people have been messaging saying, thank you so much for that taster, it was really lovely. And, you know, quite a few people have been signing up, which has been great. But so I think it's nice to have a balance of giving a bit, and then
yes, definitely
buy something from me. I'm very small and, you know.
No, but I think you do it really well, because I do think people are so scared of it. But so look up on Lisa's email list if you want some inspiration. Really, to end, I wanted to talk about, you know, you've had a lot of experiences, ups and downs. What would be your biggest business tip, I guess, for anyone starting out?
Get on with it. Just do it. I think if you're not doing it already, then you're probably not that serious about it. I mean, you'll know, it's hard work running your own business. It's very different to working for somebody else, but it's yours and it's kind of addictive in a way. And I think if you're going to do something, go for it wholeheartedly and just keep going. Like Dory says, just keep swimming.
Brilliant.
That's what you have to do. Round the rock and up and back again. You know, you've got to be adaptable, but just do it.
What's next for Lisa Stickley then? So there's lots of doodling classes.
Lots of doodling classes. And then I'm hoping to sort of carry on the idea with galleries and museums and things. So I'm launching the doodling book, Lisa Stickley Dulwich Picture Gallery, one next week, and I'm going to be doing some special things with them, but also hand in hand with my children's books and the sort of interactive doodling books. I've got an idea at the moment for maybe combining the two for kids, particularly those with dyslexia or who are struggling to read and engage with books. I'm thinking of, I've got an idea of something to keep them a bit more engaged, be it sort of colouring in within the book or, you know, some interactive thing. So that's very exciting. But the doodling is very fun and hopefully will give me some time to finally send off my proposals to my lovely agent. Sorry, Jodie, I've been rubbish.
Honestly, coming on podcasts, doing all this kind of thing instead of doing what you're supposed to be doing. And where can people find you if they want to look you up?
So I'm on Instagram as LisaStickley_studio. And I have my website, which is Lisa Stickley Studio. I am on Facebook, but I don't know how to work it. So don't ever message me on there because I can't understand it. And hopefully in the next 6 months, I will have a studio in my garden that's mid.
Ooh, exciting.
Well, the planning's done, but I need a builder now. My builder's gone AWOL. But that will be wonderful. And then I'll be having, you know, you'll be able to come, cup of tea and workshopping, amazing. Things like that in Southeast London.
Wow, amazing. Good luck. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to Creative Slurp. I hope it's inspired you to try something new in your business. If you loved it, please take the time to leave a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. See you soon, and go and chase your biggest creative business dreams. You can do it.